ebook publishers and marketing services company Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $12.99 per month. That's Downpour.com. On this episode, she's an author. That's Amy McGuire's brand name. Grammy winner Joanne Shenandoah sung at the Vatican, in Palestine, and for the Dalai Lama while working with Jim Morrison? What else is she doing? And the second installment in the New York Times best-selling Century Trilogy, right after the news, you want to know.
Can't make it, do it, makes us all the better, faster, stronger. That
don't kill me, can faster, only make me stronger. I need you to hurry up now, cause I can't wait much longer. I know I got to be right now, cause I can't get much stronger. Man, I've been waiting all night now, that's how long I've been on ya.
Hello, I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Chrissy McIntyre. And here's your art and entertainment news that you want to know. Yeah. Well, it's great to do things that you love and put your time and effort into the things that you know, it brings meaning to you. Mm-hmm. So, and somebody else that's doing a little something like that is Sting, actually.
Love Sting.
What's he doing?
Well, he hasn't really done much lately, but now he finally has an album out and a Broadway show coming out.
Really?
This September. Yes. He's been thinking about his earliest memories back in the day, growing up near the shipyards in England. And he said, and I'll do my Gordon Sumner impression, a massive ship at the end of my street, towering over the houses and blotting out the sun, he says. I was raised in this surreal industrial landscape that is still the landscape of my dreams and some of my nightmares. Mm. So he called on these kind of memories and created this album called The Last Ship. And it's a musical about a struggling British shipyard. That is so hard to say. A struggling British shipyard in the 80s.
5 times real fast.
And it's going to open on Broadway in the fall of next year. And then there's an album of the songs from that production, also called The Last Ship, which comes out in September. So you can hear the album, get to know the music, and then you can go see the Broadway show next year, which should be really exciting.
So the album comes out in this September, right?
So yeah, this September 24th, and then the Broadway show is going to open next in the fall of next year.
I can't wait to hear his music, because, you know, he's such a talented musician.
Yeah.
Of course, we all know him from The Police, you know, and, you know, Roxanne, and, you know,
sure,
Don't Stand So Close to Me, and all that stuff. But,
and his great solo career.
Yeah, he's one of the few artists, and I will just say this about Sting, Gordon Sumner. I love his title of his one album, that his first solo album he did was called Ten Sumner's Tales, which no one can figure it out. Everybody's like, oh, what a witty guy, you know, how clever is he? You know, but it's like, hey, that's my name, you know?
My name. Not really.
But he's one of those few artists that was in a huge, huge band. And then as a solo artist, he was even bigger.
Yeah, it's like Paul Simon.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
He really took a long break from
Madonna.
So he did the Police reunion tour back in 2008, but he hasn't really done any albums lately. He's like, I don't think the album would have happened at all without the initial impetus to create something for the theater. And then he said, as soon as I got myself out of the way, the songs flowed thick and fast. And, you know, I just hear that so often with artists and, you know, musicians and writers and things like that. You always have to get out of your own way. And it's just such an interesting concept. You know, you keep stopping yourself for some reason. And then when you realize you don't have to do that, it just pours out of you. Yeah, people always describe things. It's like, I didn't even write it. It wrote itself, you know?
So inspiring.
I've heard
people say that before, and you know, a couple of artists that have come to mind are pretty famous, and they were asking him, you know, this album is so great, you know, and the question was, you know, how long did it take you to write? And some people like say, it's, you know, I've been working on this for 10 years or whatever. And he goes, I took a trip to the Bahamas and it happened. Everything on that album happened on the sail down to Bahamas. So in 2 weeks.
It all just came together.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Because once you take yourself out of the element and you stop thinking about like, oh, I have to go here. I got to go here. And I got to, you know, pick up this person and go, you know, I have this. As soon as you stop and take yourself out of your own life, I love that.
Yeah.
It makes me think I need to go to the Caribbean.
Like watching TV.
Yeah. You just got to, yeah, sometimes you got to just sit back and just let it flow to you.
Yeah.
So Google, having already given the world $300 phones and $200 tablets, is now giving us the Google Chromecast for $35. It's a 2-inch black plastic dongle that connects to your television via the HDMI port and gives you access to the internet via your television, including YouTube movies, video, TV shows, Netflix, and very soon, Pandora. It can be used with almost any device. Anything that's viewable on a computer will then be able to be viewed on your television.
So let's put that into a little broader context for all of our listeners out there. It's like, you know, I have a Google TV, a Sony Google TV, so the internet's built into it.
Right.
But now it's just like if you have a TV that you can get anywhere, any TV that was built within the last, you know, 5-6 years.
Yep. As long as it's got HDMI.
It's got HDMI cable on it. Like, now with this Google Chromecast, all you do is plug that in. You don't need a Google TV or Sony TV.
Oh, all you need is Wi-Fi.
All you need is Wi-Fi.
All you need is a wireless, you know, wireless router, essentially. If you have internet in your home and a wireless router and an HDMI port on your TV.
Bam, your TV is now just converted over to an
internet-ready television. Absolutely. And it can be controlled with any device. And one of the great things is you can actually shift back and forth between devices. So you can be watching it on your TV and, oh, I need to go into the other room, you can then shift it to your Nexus tablet, which they're releasing, you know, the new Nexus tablet is coming out soon. They're just calling it the new Nexus, the 7-inch. It's going to have a higher resolution screen and a thinner, lighter body, better processor. You know, they're in competition. You know, Apple's been trying to do this with I think it's Apple AirPlay, and a few other companies have experimented with this, but nothing has had... I mean, $35. $35, and your TV is now Google, is an internet-ready television.
So, right. Charlie, would you have gotten your Google TV if this device had been out already?
Yes.
Why is that?
Because that was given to me for Christmas.
Bravo.
No, but, you know, actually, I probably wouldn't have, because... Let me say this: having the big screen, you know, Sony thing, you know, and which is a computer, it's great. I mean, once it's like when these new gadgets come out, I'm like, well, what am I going to do with that? I don't use it. But then if I get it, then I'm like, dude, what can't I do with this?
Right.
You know, but the Chromecast thing is cool because it makes it so affordable for everyone. They could put it on their TV. And you can not only can you watch Netflix or listen to Pandora and stuff like that, but you can surf the net, dude.
On your TV.
Think about all these families out there that can't afford laptops for their kids. They can buy a $35 Chromecast.
And now their TV.
And now they can do their homework on the TV.
Yep. And not only that, you know, another thing too is they're going to be releasing a software kit for developers that people can start creating programs and apps to work with it. So I certainly see a real future there for, like, if you're really into cat videos, you know, a program that will help just
sounds
show
like you
nothing but cat videos.
Cat videos.
Well, I'll tell you what.
He's speaking from the heart.
The Chromecast thing for me, I would have, you know, I would use it, and I'm really glad that they came out with it because it provides, you know, technology and it lowers the divide between, you know, families in our country. So that, you know, everyone has access to the internet on the TV, whether you own a computer or not. All you need is a router,
right?
Which, you know, and I think that's really cool to step up. You know, and so I say hats off to them. But I tell you, nothing beats live entertainment.
That's true, and that's something that we can all appreciate in the various forms it comes in. One of them being Cirque du Soleil. Have you guys ever seen any Cirque du Soleil?
I have seen one, and I think it's going to be a shock to all of you which show I saw.
Which one?
Which one?
The Beatles.
Love.
Love.
Yeah.
I saw Draelian up in Portland, and it was breathtaking. I enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I'm really stunned. When I went to Las Vegas, I saw Zumanity, which is their adult-themed show.
I saw that one.
Yeah, what did you think, Chrissy?
One. It's like they're topless.
Yeah, yeah.
Rope. It's kind of crazy.
It is.
Why didn't anyone tell me that before I went to Draelian?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I saw Love, and the reason I saw Love, because it was, you know, it was about the Beatles, and it was going to be like a really cool thing, and I saw Ringo Starr, he went and saw it at the opening night, and I saw the review, and they asked him what he thought of it, and he said, the circus and the Beatles, how can you go wrong?
Well, the cool thing is, what I really like is that really Cirque du Soleil has redefined the concept of circus, because Guy Laliberté, who is the guy who started it, he's a 53-year-old, he basically uses really highly trained artists and acrobats that entertain audiences with these performances that incorporate dance and theater and gymnastics in very talented ways. The interesting thing is that he started off being a wandering street performer himself.
You know, that just blows my mind.
I know. He was just wandering the streets. He was really inspired to travel, and he left home when he was 14, and he found that street performing was really his ticket to see the world. So he traveled all through Europe and learned these skills and got really excited about it. And he started Cirque du Soleil in 1984.
Sorry, that's just not something that would ever cross my mind. Like, street performance, that's the way I'm going to start my career.
No kidding.
You know, when you're a teenager, you realize that's just such a teenage thought. But it's amazing that he went with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, totally.
And he's an artiste.
Yeah. He's an artiste. He returned to Canada and he tried to settle down to a normal job, but it just wasn't his thing. And he realized that he's got to do it. And so it's fascinating because he is now on the Forbes billionaires list.
Oh,
and
my
He's number 17 on Canada's list of richest people. So his net worth was reported to be like $1.8 billion.
I'm quitting my job, man.
Yeah, it's just beautiful. And although he's really risen to this incredible wealth, he holds on to the hopes and dreams that when he was still striving to make his mark in the world. And he says, I am blessed for what I have, but I believed in it from the beginning. Today, the dream is the same. I still want to travel. I still want to entertain. And most certainly still want to have fun.
Cool. You know what? That is so cool and so inspiring because, you know, here's a guy, you know, that's like, you know, middle class family in Canada. You know, he wants to be a performer. So he's a street performer all throughout Europe. And it comes back to Canada, does the same thing. And the guy becomes a billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and right. But then, you know, if you look at, you know, we were just talking about performances and his different shows. I mean, when you look what he's brought to the world, I mean, it's like, you know, everything that these guys have done has just been so incredibly inspiring.
Totally.
And I think it's because he surrounded himself with other people that were creative.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting how he started off with only 73 employees, and they're now up to, let's see, 5,000 employees worldwide. Wow. Yeah.
I think this is really one of those things, you hear it over and over again, that, you know, do what you love and the money will follow.
Yes.
You know, and this is really, you know, I bet you if he told his parents, hey, I want to be a street performer, I bet it probably wouldn't have gone over well. But he's proven that by doing what he loved, he's made not just a career, but an empire.
Well, there was a TED Talk. There was a woman who was a street performer. I think you sent me the link. She ended up getting millions of dollars, and she was talking about how being a street performer taught her to connect with people.
Right. I do remember that she was an artist. She's a singer, and
I saw that too. And it was such an inspiring TED Talk.
When she had her Kickstarter thing, she came out to the coffee house in New York, and she came out naked to the coffee house and had people draw on her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about that on a past show.
Right.
And so it feels so relevant because she was talking about
$23 million on that.
It's amazing.
I mean, she didn't make it. I mean, they gave her the $23 million for her next project, and she became a successful musician, which is what she wanted to do.
Yeah.
But Sai, you're right, that she started off working street art.
Yeah. So what are we doing on this podcast? We need to get out on the street. We're sitting in a room. This
when we come out
to
New York, maybe, right?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I kind of grown accustomed to living indoors, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Running water. I'm a huge fan.
But I'll tell you what. Maybe we'll come out to New York and do that. But I'll tell you a guy in New York who will not be performing on the street, and that's Alec Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin.
He would get such good tips, yeah. though.
Who's going to tip Alec Baldwin? He punches everybody out.
Yeah.
Punch all the people. Like, that's it? You're only giving me a dollar?
Wham.
Give me a dollar, bam.
And just wait for the nasty voicemail message.
Yeah, really.
God forbid you try to take a picture. Forget it.
Well, he did come from humble beginnings and has risen to fame. So Alec Baldwin right now, though, he is promoting his new documentary, Seduced and Abandoned. It's about his journey pitching a film to potential backers during a trip to Cannes. And a reporter at the Television Critics Association summer tour in Beverly Hills brought up that he spoke with many producers in the documentary who commented on the importance of a franchise. The reporter then mentioned The Hunt for Red October, the only film Baldwin played Jack Ryan in, and asked if the star realized the importance of franchises when he left the project. Baldwin said, "We shot that film in 1989, and to see where the franchise business has evolved, yeah, I guess if I had any brains, I would have stayed with the franchise knowing what I know now, because it does give you some freedom. You know, a lot of people, they don't like to be pigeonholed or typecasted. You know, you can look back on Johnny Depp with 21 Jump Street or something like that. They don't want to get involved in these franchises because they're afraid they can't break out. But, you know, things have changed so much.
Totally.
You know, since the since 89, even just all the different media we get, internet, you know, people are doing stuff all the time. So you can definitely go into different things. You don't have to be tied into that franchise.
Well, you know, I think that Baldwin makes a good point about, yeah, if I knew what I knew then, now I would have continued to do Jack Ryan because it gives you the freedom. Johnny Depp's a good example, Cyrus. Because,
Hugh Jackman.
Johnny Depp especially is a good example because, well, you know, he was a popular movie actor, just like Alec Baldwin was. And he did a lot of quirky movies, just like Alec Baldwin did. But he had the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise behind him, which allows him to do whatever he wants. He can be in Rango.
Yeah.
He can be in a movie with Angelina Jolie.
He can make Finding Neverland.
He can do whatever he wants because he's got this franchise coming in.
Yeah. And that's what Hugh Jackman. Hugh Jackman's a perfect example of that. You know, it used to be superhero movies until people seem to forget, but doing a superhero movie 15 years ago was a kiss of death. I mean, that was it. If you did that, you weren't doing anything else. You know, Jackman took the role of Wolverine. He agreed to do multiple films, and it's his bread and butter, but he can go off and do Les Mis or Prisoners, his new one that he has coming
out. Good point,
because he's got, you know, and nobody goes, oh, that's Wolverine trying to sing.
You know, that is such an excellent point, because here's the deal, dude. Hugh Jackman, right? When you say Hugh Jackman, I think Wolverine, I think, like, I don't like it. I don't care for him. I don't care for any of the superhero movies. They don't do anything for me.
Love him.
But
I love him as Wolverine, though.
Yeah, but then, you know, when you say Les Mis, right, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, that's the guy in Les Mis. That's right. That's right. You know, so, I mean, like, Robert Downey Jr. is Iron Man, and he's probably the richest out of all the franchises with his Iron Man.
And Sherlock Holmes.
But it doesn't – you watch an Iron Man movie, and it's all fluff, dude. I mean, it's like – it doesn't even show what the depth of an actor he really is, because this guy really is a good actor.
Yeah. It's kind of like the conversation between Ben Affleck and Matt Damon in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, where he's like, you do the – you know, you do the franchise pick, then you do the art house pick, then you do the safe pick,
right, and
then
that's,
you do the pick you want to do.
But that's what Alec Baldwin was saying. He goes, the first one in the program of one for you, one for me.
Yeah. And he – you know, that's – I find it – I wish I knew. I mean – did he walk away? I couldn't tell.
He did. He walked away.
And that's such a shame because The Hunt for Red October was a great movie. He had a chance really to be the American James Bond. That franchise, there's so many. I think what Ben Affleck has been the main role, has been Jack Ryan.
You know what? Jack Ryan.
Harrison Ford.
Alec Baldwin did Jack Ryan. He was the first. And he was great in it. Yep. It was a great book. It was a great movie.
And they
offered him the series, the franchise. He said no.
Right.
The next film he did was where he met his wife, Kim Basinger. He did a comedy called Marion Man.
Nice.
Really?
Yeah. I'll tell you somebody
but he did a lot of great movies in that time after A Hunt for October. He did Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah, he was great.
Oh, God. And you know he's only in that movie for like 5.5 minutes.
I'm sorry, Jerry. Only closers get coffee.
Yeah, well, his new movie, Seduced and Abandoned, will premiere on HBO. And another thing Baldwin does is a podcast. And he's got 10 new episodes, which will be premiering on PRX pretty soon.
Yeah, you know what? That's so cool. Have you heard his podcast?
Yeah.
It's called Here's the Thing, which he stole from us because that was our premise to begin. We started before he did. But, you know, we'll go ahead. We'll let him take one for the team. The first podcast he did, I listened to it in New York. He did it at his apartment. which I'm guessing is kind of nice.
But he's right next door to Chrissy's.
I think he's financed it with Capital One.
Sometimes when I go away on vacation, he gets my mail to me.
Yeah, he did an interview with Michael Douglas.
Oh, wow.
And
he does a great, he does a really good interview.
The thing about Alec Baldwin is he has one of those voices. Alec Baldwin could be reading you the instructions on how to defrost a refrigerator, and you'd be hanging on every word.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So turn the temperature down. Yeah.
You know, an interesting thing I find about Alec Baldwin, too, is, you know, there used to be a real, for the longest time, actors, especially A and B list actors, would not do television commercials in America. They do it in other countries. They do stuff in Japan and Europe and whatever, but they wouldn't here. And I really noticed the trend shifting with Alec Baldwin doing those Capital One commercials. And since that point, I've seen more and more what I would consider A and B list actors doing actual commercials, not just voice work. They do voice work, but he's actually kind of started that trend, and it's an interesting thing to see.
Well, you know, I don't know. I just think it goes in ebbs and flows because Bill Cosby is a pretty big actor, and he's been doing Jell-O for 100
years. That's true. Yeah, that was in the early to mid 80s.
In fact,
and then
that's like the greatest impersonation of him. Like when people do impressions, they always do the pudding
pops.
The
Jell-O pudding pops with the thing. Yeah. The thing to my brother.
Speaking of Alec Baldwin's podcast, I think a really good interview for him to do would be Shirley Jones of the Partridge Family. You guys remember Shirley, right? The mom and the singer?
Yeah, Mrs. Marion Partridge. The librarian from The Music Man.
All I can say is, Oklahoma.
Marion. She's of all those things. But she had kind of a squeaky clean image, but she sort of shed that with her sort of tell-all biography or memoir book.
Do tell.
Ooh, yes, please do tell. She, she recounts her growing up, you know, which is the sort of standard thing. And then she talks about her career with working with musical theater masters of Rodgers and Hammerstein and some actors. And I love how she dishes on them, including Marlene Brando, king of the retakes to exhaustion, and Jimmy Stewart, charmingly ditzy. You know, I love when they talk about those
things. Can we do that one again? I don't think I got it. Eat your soup.
But a substantial part of the book is spent on her troubled marriage to the late Jack Cassidy, the glossily handsome actor and singer whom she describes in a passage as her first lover and sexual Svengali, and whose lessons she shares candidly.
Hello.
So,
come on, get happy.
Yeah, she really did.
I think I love you. That includes X-rated, spoiler alert, Cassie's impressive endowment.
Ooh.
Jones's own highly sexed nature that makes orgasms a breeze. What about you? That's a lot of information. And a threesome with another woman. Yuck, she says when asked about the experience. It also includes Cassidy's premarital sexual encounter with Cole Porter. Ooh. That Jones says left her unfazed, and her apparent tolerance for his infidelities. He had quite a few. And Jones was, in an interview, Jones said that she felt that she could be this candid because, frankly, she's turning 80. She said, I'm going to be 80, so my memoir might as well be a tell-all. I mean, he might as well now.
You know, it's hard to believe that she's 80 years old.
I know. She looks fantastic.
Yeah, she does look fantastic. And then just think about Jack Cassidy and being quite the playboy. Hard to imagine that David Cassidy was his son, huh?
I know.
One of the odds.
It's funny. I know. And then she actually, I think he didn't know that she was cast on The Partridge Family. And so they met on the show. And he was like, what are you doing here? She's like, yeah, I'm playing your mom.
Creepy alert.
Yeah. Creepy. But that's okay. They figured it out. They had a very good run on that show. So yeah, so it's interesting. So if you're, I don't know if that's your cup of tea. It's a lot of information about her sexual exploits, but you know, it should be an interesting
read. Good for her for being open about it. Hey.
So it's a peek behind the curtain and apparently the bathrobe as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's good stuff. I know. It's
Well, you know, that I got to tell you, that is very shocking because growing up, I loved The Music Man and, you know, she had such a squeaky, clean image. But another thing that I really liked that didn't really have such a squeaky, clean image was the band Kiss. Who I am a huge fan of course. And,
the Knights in Satan Service?
Yes, of course. Yeah, you know that's exactly what it stands for. Kiss has brought football back to Los Angeles for wow. the first time in quite some time. Now, granted, it is a arena league football team, which is still quite enjoyable. I enjoy watching arena football. So now that KISS owns an arena league football team in Los Angeles, let me just get all the jokes out of the way, okay? So just hold your – here it is. It's all in one. All right, so here we go. The team is going to be playing next March in Detroit, Rock City, Los Angeles. It will run a non-traditional offense, not the pistol, not the shotgun, but the love gun.
Yeah.
Players will be encouraged to rock and roll all night and party every day. Following every touchdown, the team will go for a deuce. They'll keep the visitors' locker room hotter than hell. And, of course, the team physician will be... Dr. Love. All right, so we got that all out of the way. All right, feel joke
I feel
down.
Good about
right.
that, Jerry. I feel really good.
All right, good. So the team's name will actually be, and this is not part of the joke, L.A. KISS. Their helmet designs are going to be amazing.
Are you sure that's not part of the joke?
I swear it is not.
And will KISS.
And will Beth be on their helmets?
I don't think so. No. The helmets will be amazing, though, and that's their word, amazing. And as an incentive for season ticket holders, they will hold a private concert. So they're encouraging people to buy season tickets, and in exchange for not only getting to watch fast-paced Arena League football, you get a private concert with KISS. The AFL, as a fast-paced, high-action band, this partnership with the AFL was an obvious fit for us. Of course, that was Gene Simmons. With arena football, you're much closer to the action. Sitting in the front row is like putting a folding chair on the hash mark of an NFL game. And it's it's true.
Right.
And it's one of the only sports where you can experience this level of intensity. I actually enjoy arena football, and it is. It's a different experience. And Gene Simmons, as you may or may not know, is the master of marketing. So I cannot wait to see the different ways they plan on marketing.
You know what?
That guy's got his hands in everything.
I'm glad you said it about Gene Simmons because... I saw an interview with Gene Simmons recently, within the last week. And they were, giving him a hard time about KISS as a franchising machine, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Henry Rollins, the punk guy. Was
Rollins Band, yeah.
Yeah, he was interviewing him. And so Gene Simmons says, and I didn't even think about it, but he says, every rock band does it. He goes, you're in the merchandising business. He goes, do you sell T-shirts at your concerts?
Yeah.
You're in the merchandising business.
Yep. They just do it better.
Yeah.
And KISS does it better than anything. I mean, you think of a product, I can almost guarantee there's a KISS version of it. Need a toothbrush? There's a KISS toothbrush.
No.
Plan on dying next week? There are KISS caskets.
You're joking.
I am not kidding. There literally is just about KISS everything.
And I love this quote here from Paul Stanley from KISS, the guitarist. He says, the whole idea of an alternative, meaning the arena football, to what has become a corporate sport is very intriguing and resonates with us, Paul Stanley said, who's a really cool dude. And we had his wife's actress.
Ex-wife.
Yeah. We had her on the show.
Pamela Bowen.
Pamela Bowen.
Yeah, that's right.
It makes me wonder, too, like, who's the next musician to buy a pro team? Like, would it be Snoop Lion?
Right, that would
Justin
make sense.
Bieber?
I mean, he's a huge soccer fan, and, you know, that's when he changed his name to Snoop Lion when he was down in Jamaica. You know, soccer's very big down there. Yeah, Kid Rock, you know, that he's a huge him and Eminem, I could see buying, like, say, the Detroit Lions. Yeah. I mean, they couldn't get any worse. So,
Well, and to harp on this whole marketing thing, KISS is from the East Coast. They're an East Coast rock
from New
band.
York.
Yep, yeah,
right.
He was raised
so
in New York.
So this is a Los Angeles team, you know.
Interesting.
And the big bands in Los Angeles, like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, might not lend themselves to like this kind of corporate machine. So, you know, just to hammer in again how strong a brand KISS is.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. Yeah, because Gene grew up in New York. They've always been East Coast guys. And to put it out in L.A. is, I think, is probably a good thing for them. I think part of it, too, is L.A., you know.
I think the
so
majority
long.
Reason is they all live in Los Angeles.
That's true. That's
and
true.
Also, maybe there was a team for sale.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, whatever team was for sale is being moved there because L.A. did not have an arena football. They didn't have any football. So
okay.
Yeah, whatever team it was they bought, they're bringing with them.
Excellent. Well, there you go. I mean, they lost the Raiders, right? They don't have any football.
Yeah, they had the Rams. Yeah. They lost them. They had the Raiders. And
well,
they lost
the KISS brand kind of fits in with the Raiders.
That's right.
They
did
silver
the
and black.
Point. Yep. That's kind of funny. I would love to. Hopefully, maybe they'll get enough of an inroad they can actually buy the Raiders. Because you're right, the color scheme works perfectly. The fans dress very similar to people at Kiss concerts.
They do.
Seems like a match made in hell.
Where do you go when you need to know? Go to Jerry Renfro. He knows. Where do you go when you need to know? Go to Jerry Renfro. He knows.
And now you know with Jerry Renfro. You know, Hollywood can sometimes be like a crazy bipolar uncle. He can't remember what he had for lunch, but he can tell you what the weather was like on the Tuesday in 1974 when he found a quarter on the sidewalk outside of his house. Sometimes Hollywood and movie fans will never let you forget or move on. Just ask any Superman fan if Warner Brothers made a mistake not bringing Brandon Routh back as the lead for Man of Steel. And sometimes Hollywood can be very forgiving and overlook your transgressions. This axiom is particularly true when it comes to A-list directors and actors. Just look at Woody Allen. The genius that brought us Sleepers, Bananas, and Annie Hall has also inflicted on the world Stardust Memories, Whatever Works, and The Curse of the Jade Scorpion. Ben Affleck gave the world Geely, Jersey Girl, and Reindeer Games. But his apology, directing The Town and the Academy Award-winning Argo, has resulted in Hollywood rewarding him with the role of his dreams as the Caped Crusader Batman in the upcoming Batman vs. Superman movie. With that in mind, here's a list of some of Hollywood's most acclaimed directors and films we have chosen to turn a blind eye to when we talk about their amazing body of work. When I say Francis Ford Coppola, you probably think of The Godfather, its amazing sequel, The Godfather Part II, and Apocalypse Now. All brilliant films that will forever be held up as the pinnacles of cinematic achievement. But let us not forget that the Godfather franchise didn't end with two like many say it should have. Coppola gave us Godfather Part III, even though we didn't ask, and the, some would say, lackluster interpretations of S.E. Hinton's gritty books The Outsiders and The Rumblefish. Gus Van Sant received critical acclaim with films like My Own Private Idaho, Elephant, and Drugstore Cowboy, as well as commercial success helming films like Good Will Hunting and Milk. But really, Gus, a shot-for-shot remake of Psycho? We'll just pretend that didn't happen. Oliver Stone, the man who taught us greed is good with Wall Street and showed the ugliness of the Vietnam War with Platoon and Born on the 4th of July, also gifted us with Any Given Sunday, which I wouldn't see again on any given day at all, and Alexander, the epic that was so epic it epically failed in a very epic way. I personally love Natural Born Killers, but it's generally disliked by critics and viewers. Like the fictional Sharks team from Sunday, you can't win them all, Oliver. Finally, let us not forget that the genius that brought us Alien, Gladiator, Black Hawk Down, and my personal favorite, Blade Runner, also brought us Kingdom of Heaven, Robin Hood, and G.I. Jane. Ridley Scott is a master visionary, but sometimes that vision is blind. But fear not. To all the Coppolas and Stones of the filmmaking world, we are a forgiving bunch. But I mean it, Gus. If you pull off that shot-for-shot remake thing five or six more times, I'm out of here. And now you know with Jerry Renfro.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Downpour's special feature.
Chained our hearts in vain, we jumped, never asking why. We kissed, I fell under your spell of love no one could deny. Don't you ever say I just walked away, I will always want you.
Hailing from Canada, author Amy McGuire's five-book saga hits stride in this delightful conversation with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me, Now Stay There. Today, we're really honored to have on Amy McGuire. She's an author from Canada, and she has a series of books out called The Hope Valley Saga, and she's here to tell us all about it. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Edward.
How's things going in Canada? Are you nice weather out there?
Yeah, we've had cold days and then warm days. It doesn't seem like the weather can make up its mind. So today's warm, though. It's been a nice sunny one.
So tell us a little bit about the Hope Valley Saga. And see, the first book is called The Heart's Discovery. And then you have a follow-up book out right now, the sequel, and it's called Worlds Apart. So get us, for all of our listeners out there, let's get introduced to the characters and what they can expect when they make this purchase and start reading some Amy Maguire.
Okay, well, The Heart's Discovery and Worlds Apart are part of a 5-book saga, which starts out the first three books are the story of Angeline and Gabriel, and then the last two are going to actually be about Gabriel's sisters, Leah and Evelyn. They get their own books. So the first two books are The Heart's Discovery. Angeline and Gabriel meet. Angeline's from Ecuador. Her stepfather is an anthropologist, and they come over to Hope Valley because he's studying the native peoples in the area. And Gabriel is the son of a camp director there, which the camp is run during the summers at Hope Valley, and that's kind of how they meet through that. And the second book is kind of after their initial meeting. She has to go back to Ontario, and they're growing up, kind of a coming of age. The second was kind of a coming of age book. So
this is the story of their romance, right? It's a romance novel, correct?
Yes,
okay.
I found that I have trouble writing anything but. I've tried to write other things in the past that aren't so romantic, and I just always seem to manage to sneak some romance in there. So
you're a true romantic at heart.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So they're from these two different places. She's from Central America. He's from North America and Canada. And so she's got a very different culture than he does. She's in the lives near the Andes Mountains, and so she is in this place that's warm year-round and often dry, and then she comes to British Columbia where it's wet and cold a lot of the year. And she's been living in a landlocked place, so she also gets kind of seasick. She's never been in the ocean before, and on her way there, there's this one scene that I wrote that I kind of enjoyed writing, that she's kind of seasick, and she's not quite sure that she is even going to like Hope Valley, and kind of story goes from there.
Oh, okay, great. Now, do you find it easier to write the story or write the dialogue?
The story, for sure. I'm definitely find it easier to do the narration. The dialogue kind of happens. A lot of my characters, they just basically react to the dialogue, or the dialogue is a reaction to the what's happening. I don't generally plan out the two sections. It's usually narration, then I go, oh, they should really be talking. I actually, when I was first starting to write, had a lot of help from other writers saying, you should have a lot more dialogue. So I'd go back in and say, okay, what would they say in these scenes? And then my characters would kind of tell me what they wanted to say in those scenes.
And do you take on the persona of the character when you're writing? You know, I mean, male or female? When you're writing, let's say, you know, you're writing, you know, the woman's part, and so do you become the woman, or when you're writing the man's part, do you write it from the male point of view? The reason I ask you that is it's interesting because there's a writer, M.C. Beaton from England, that that we publish, and he also writes as a woman. We do his books both, you know, if it's an M.C. Beaton book, it's from a man's point of view. And then he has another series of books that he writes where he writes as Marion Chesney.
Yeah.
So I was curious, you know, as an author yourself, I mean, do you take on those personas?
I don't know that I take them on per se. I mean, I try to kind of get into their heads. But it was interesting when I first came out with the first book, I had a lot of comments saying that my female character wasn't as three-dimensional as my main character, or my male character. And that surprised me because I didn't think that I knew that much about teenage boys, but I guess I do because I was able to write Gabriel as a much more three-dimensional character. I had to work harder at Angeline being more three-dimensional. So I don't know if I actually went into the persona so much as the characters just kind of talked to me and said this is what they wanted to say and how they wanted to be. So.
Yeah, no, I was always curious about that because it doesn't necessarily have to be like the lead romantic, although you write romance novels. I mean, if you're in the storyline and there's a, you know, a camp instructor or somebody like that, do you take on their persona too? And, you know, like how would they react or what would they say, you know?
Yeah, well, it's weird because I mean, maybe I do kind of take them on, but it's more like they talk to me and each of the characters, this is the way they want to be. They're all very different characters. One family is from Ireland, another one's from Germany. They're kind of a collection of different cultures and and personalities that are all kind of stuck together in this little valley. I mean, we've got the people from Ecuador and then her stepfather's from Scotland, and they all have their different things that they bring to the story, and they just kind of tell me their backgrounds and their backstories.
It makes sense because, you know, when you read a book by an author, say we're reading The Heart's Discovery, you know, we read it from, your storyline, from your perspective and stuff like that. And if they were to make it into a movie, then they would bring in a screenwriter who would just change it. He would keep the story intact, but he would do the dialogue. This is what they're going to say, you know?
So he would have hopefully he'd have something to work with, because I have many different characters. And, like, I have hopefully enough that I can make a couple more books in this series that people will kind of remember those characters from before and go, oh, yeah, I want to learn about them. So
now, what about audio? Are your books going to be available in audio books, or would you like to see them available as audio?
I definitely want to see them as audio. I haven't been able to get around to it because in the last almost year, I had to start working part time, and I've got my daughter who's 5, and it's just been a bit of a busier year than when I first published my first book. But I would definitely love to get an audiobook done, and to get somebody who could do, you know, could do a teenage boy voice and could do the adults and bring my book to life. I definitely want to, because it is becoming kind of between, you know, the Kindle and between audio, those are kind of becoming the two. Now the paperbacks are completely going away, the dinosaur, but they're less popular. And I know more people would be listening to my books than reading necessarily. So I'm definitely interested in doing an audiobook for the series when I get a chance, and getting somebody professional to do the voices, because I'm a writer. I'm not a narrator per se. So,
Now where are your books are available on Amazon, correct? And on Smashwords?
Yeah, Amazon and Smashwords. So I've got them in the ebook and the paperback format. And I have my own website. All the links, I guess, will be with you guys, but shesanauthor.com is my website, and that's where all the links are to all of my books. And then hopefully the third one's going to be out, I'm hoping, for December, January 2014 at the absolute latest.
And do you have a working title for it?
Dreams Come True, yep.
Dreams Come True. Oh, okay, great. Yep. I like that title. And your website is She's an Author, which I got to tell you is a cool, cool name. Where did you come up with that?
My sister had this email address called She's a Philosophy Nut, and I like the she's part. And when I started branding myself, I was like, well, I could do my author name, but if I ever decided, like, I've known some authors who have used multiple author names for different genres, so I wanted to have something that would kind of brand me, but I would have the flexibility to move around within that. So She's an Author just kind of came out of that, and I've got She's an Author blog, She's an Author Facebook, She's an Author website.
And these are all She's an Author.com, right?
Well, the website's She's an Author.com. The blog is She's an Author.wordpress.com. I've got a Facebook page that She's an Author. There's no numbers. So if you type in She's an Author, one word, most of the time, hopefully you'll find me anyways. You may find variations, but I'm trying to brand myself so that people can go, oh, yeah, she's an author. And it makes sense because, you know, well, what does your wife do? She's an author. It works.
No, it's beautiful. And I'm surprised that it wasn't taken already. But, hats off to you.
When I on Twitter, too. Yeah, I was surprised that it wasn't, because Twitter's so big. When I went on there and chose She's an Author, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to have to add in a number. Nope, nobody had taken it. And there's, I mean, Twitter and Facebook and Pinterest and all those, the big, look, I think Twitter is even bigger than Facebook for advertising for writers, and nobody had taken it. So I snatched it up as fast as I could.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we, as a company, I think the reason that we flourish so much is because we embrace technology. We don't run from it. So, yeah. And we always keep the core idea behind it that, and I tell Si and all these people that, listen, everything is the same as it has been since day one. We're just taking a different road there. It's just, people have still watching movies, whether it's a drawing on a cave wall and, or in a movie theater or on their smartphone,
Yeah.
You know, so if you keep that in mind and then just embrace the new technology, then you're fine.
Yeah, and I'm trying. Like I said, I'm still new and I've got a lot to learn, but I have a lot of slate of friends who are helping me kind of limp along and teaching me some of this technology. And there's always, I have several writers groups that I'm part of on Facebook, and they're always putting up, this is the latest thing, you need to check it out. And I've, there's this, oh, I'm going to get it wrong. It's Bublish.com. I just got into them. Where they're really neat, where you can actually put up just a section of your book, and then you've got another bubble that you can tell them what you were thinking when you wrote it or where you got the idea. And it's something that I'm going to get, when I get a minute, I'm going to get into. And a lot of the writer friends of mine are getting into that, and they say it's a real good way to get people interested in your book, because it's kind of like a, you know how Amazon does this see inside section? The Bublish does that, but Amazon only lets you do the first, what is it, 10, what is it, like a certain percentage of your book anyways. And Bublish, you can like pick a section anywhere in your book and kind of bring that out and talk about it. So.
Well, that's great. I haven't heard of that yet. You're right. Technology is just so amazing. We did a story about a guy who did made $1 million. He's an author. And he released his book on, he self-published it himself on Smashwords.
Mm-hmm.
And he just did it as a lark, because people told him how good his book was. But he released it at a chapter at a time.
Yep.
And he got such a huge following. And then the guy made $1 million. But the bottom line of the whole story was he wrote a really good book.
Yeah, that's the thing. He would have written a good book, and he would have had an audience had the patience. My one unfortunate thing about writing to young adults is they don't have the patience sometimes. I've had different people read my book say, oh, it's great, and I like the length, and a lot of the younger set, which unfortunately I'm writing to, the younger set saying, oh, this book is too long, and I couldn't wait for it to be done. And I'm like, wow, the attention span of different age groups. Like, so he was probably writing for adults, that's my guess, to be able to do that kind of stuff. So it does, the different genres you're writing for, the different age groups, you definitely have to think more with people you're writing.
Well, yeah, young people do have a short attention span, and that's just the way that it goes. Again, since day one, it's been that way.
Yeah.
Well, Amy, I want to thank you so much for being on today, and I hope everybody goes out there and picks up a copy of your books, The Heart's Discovery, or the sequel to it, The World's Apart. And when you come out with your third book, you'll have to come back on and tell us all about it.
Will do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.
To learn more about Amy McGuire, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
Tonight I wear black. In the middle of the road, I face no tomorrow, I've nowhere to go. Searching and losing, wondering why, tonight I wear black.
Joanne Shenandoah, considered one of the most celebrated Native American artists, got down to earth with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me, Not Stay There. Today, we're really privileged to have on Joanne Shenandoah from New York. Hi, Joanne. How are you doing?
Hey there. Doing fabulous things.
It is so good to talk to you again. It's been a while since we've talked to you.
Yeah, well, time flies, doesn't it?
You know, it certainly does. Oh, my gosh, it does.
For sure. It doesn't matter, like, how long the day seems. It still goes by quickly.
It sure does. Well, for all of our listeners out there, you are Native America's most celebrated artist, and you're a Grammy winner, and you have performed all over the world, North America, South America, Europe, Australia, Korea. Have you been on the moon lately?
No, but, you know, the Hopis were warning the U.S. about going to the moon and not to disturb anything. This was quite some time ago, and they said if they did, that there would be an imbalance in the air. So, I mean, we can travel there in our thoughts and our dreams, but there comes a point.
Yeah.
You know, so clearly we've been experiencing some, you know, difficult times on our planet. And, you know, I can't imagine living during a more important time.
You know, and it's a very important time. It's also a very exciting time. You know, when you talked about the
you know, the Hopi saying that, you know, don't go to the moon, you'll disturb the balance. The first thing that flashed to me was like when you go to the doctor and they give you a medication.
Yeah.
And so many people will take it till they feel better, then they stop taking it, and then they end up, you know, getting sick or the situation's even worse. And then when they go back to the doctor, he says, you know, there was a reason I gave you that medication. Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, it even goes, you know, the next step. I mean, there are people like hydrofracking.
Yeah.
Thinking that's actually going to, like, it's a kind of a quick fix to the paying the mortgage. But on the other hand, where does it leave the earth once we've, you know, once we're long gone? So, I mean, there are a lot of decisions to be made, and while each of us may not realize that each individual has a right and responsibility, that it does affect us all, it affects everyone, no matter who, you know, think you are, even though you think you might be, you know, not making any impact. Everyone makes an impact. We all have a footprint.
You know, I remember that from our last conversation, and it's so true, but you know, it's hard to put that in perspective, because it's easy to say, well, it doesn't really matter what I do, you know.
Well, yeah, but then you look, okay, you say to yourself, okay, how many seedless cucumbers and seedless watermelon are you able to buy? And it took 40 years for them to get rid of seeds and watermelon. Imagine the amount of effort just to be able to get rid of seeds, let alone the people who are trying to maintain seeds. So that's been big on my radar lately is, you know, all the radiation, the impact of what the tsunami had from Japan on our country, and how we look at our future. How do we really look at it? Do we think, okay, just because I throw out, you know, all this paper, or don't recycle, or don't do this, or don't do that, it really makes a huge difference. And you look at one family and the amount of waste that takes place. I mean, I know that's not the brunt of our conversation, because when I travel the world, I'm actually trying to bring some sort of genuine peace. And we've been so blessed since I've talked to you last. We actually got a chance to go to Israel and perform in Manger Square in Palestine, Christmas Eve day. And
wow.
Yeah, it was remarkable. I mean, when you see the many generations that have passed since, you know, Masada, Herod's temple, the people who were living in those times, and the artwork and the beauty and the place where they kept their seeds. It really rings true. It's like, wow, look at this. This was a beautiful temple built toward preserving oneself, for example. And here we come fast forward, you know, 2013, and then you're looking, okay, in the Iroquois way, we believe we're only supposed to look seven generations beyond us, but I think it goes a lot further than that, and I think a lot of people have heard of that. I mean, some companies have actually used that as their name for paper products that are recycled, but there comes a point in time where you say, look at that, look at history, isn't it amazing? You know, and what's going on today, I've heard a lot of people calling me about the what's going on in Syria. You know, and so here we are. Here we are.
No, here we are. Now, when you performed in Israel, what was the occasion?
Well, the occasion was to bring peace. And, of course, during a time of Christmas, the time of Christ. And I'll be honest, when I was young, I was a Christian. I totally read the Bible 16 times. By the time I was 16,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I did. I could play Bible trivia real well, and I probably still can, but I didn't expect it to affect me so profoundly. There were places that we went, I mean, example, the Garden of Gethsemane. You could feel the presence of Spirit there. It was so powerful. And where Jesus was crucified. I mean, I turned to my own native religion because that's where I hail from, and I needed to learn more about it. And I understand and realize that there's a lot to learn from every culture, every tradition, every song, every, you know, ritual around the world, because we are meant to live in harmony and balance with each other in the natural world. So it's got to start somewhere, you know. So
right.
That's kind of where I am. So I was like, yeah, I'll go. I will see what's going on there. And yes, I saw a huge wall. I saw people divided. I saw amazing things. I mean, I may be going back again this Christmas, and we'll see what happens. But the children of Palestine, they want peace. The mothers, the life givers, we call the women. You know, no woman wants to see her child or her husband or her brother or her relative being decimated by war. No woman on earth that I know of. If you were to say, okay, put your child in the front line, what woman is going to say, yeah, okay, go?
Well, no. They. Everyone has a reservation about that.
Yeah, for sure.
And yeah, they just do. I mean, we've experienced that in our family, and it's not something that...
It's not pretty.
No, it's not.
Yeah, I have a very good friend who sent all of her four sons to this latest war in Afghanistan. And I'll tell you what, it's had a huge impact on
it
that
has,
family.
It's had a huge impact on our family. My nephew, my brother's son, he was killed in Afghanistan 2 years ago. He's only 20 years old, and he was a Marine, a recon Marine.
Wow.
So, yeah, you know, and it's always one of those things that you think is never going to happen to you, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's not really any way to, like, think about the future of our planet. Like, how many do we have to give up in order to have freedom, for example? For me, I'll be right straight up front. I've always, you know, been one to talk about the Iroquois Tree of Peace, how we put aside our weapons of war, how we want to live in peace, how we should live in harmony and balance with each other. And then there comes a time where you look at the earth fighting back, you know, and that's right in front of us. and there are people that are really afraid. I mean, our young people are afraid. And I'm going out there, and I've been traveling, I've been doing what I do, and it doesn't matter. I cannot discriminate. I sang at the Vatican, at St. Peter's Basilica, and some of our traditional people were very upset with me for that. And I was like, but this is my mission. This is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to bring songs of peace.
And how was that? How did you like the Vatican?
I love the acoustics. I mean, the acoustics are gorgeous. But it was overwhelming. It was remarkable looking at all the art and all the gold and all the, you know, the power behind, you know, those walls. It's just huge.
Did you sing for the Pope?
Well, I imagine he may have been listening. There were thousands of people. You know, but we sang for the canonization of the very first native saint. Her name was Gadali Dagaquipa. She was Mohawk.
Uh-huh.
Known as Lily of the Mohawks. And the very first time a Native American saint was canonized. So there were several thousand Native people, let alone thousands and thousands of others from all over the world. I mean, it was a huge, huge event. And
what song did you play?
Well, I didn't play a song, but I have a song that I wrote just for this event, as well as an event a week earlier to sing for His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
Well, let's hear some of it.
Okay, and this one's called May There Be Peace. The words translate to this. May there be peace to everyone around the world. Let our minds be one.
I see one and on your hage. Skana. I see one and on your hage.
Beautiful. Now, you know what, this is for my own curiosity. You and your daughter, Leah, recorded with the title track to Path to Zero with Jim Morrison. can you tell me about that?
Yeah, that's so funny. I was like, they'd go, who else would you like to work with? I said, well, maybe John Lennon.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was an amazing project. Sting, Bono, there are a number of wonderful Sinead O'Connor people on this recording with Jonathan Elias. And this recording is to bring awareness about nuclear activity. And you may or may not be aware that there have been numerous attempts to, I should say, and probably better word would be an infiltration of nuclear activities going on reservations in our country. So this was a song that was given by Jim, or a piece of poetry, I want to say, about just that. And it was never heard before.
Wow.
So when they asked me, would you consider, I was like, yes. And they said, what song would you like to sing on? I was like, are you kidding me? Jim Morrison.
Oh.
Yeah, so we went to New York and we recorded with Jonathan, and it's called Path to Zero. It's a beautiful production.
Where can we find Path to Zero for all our listeners out there?
Yeah, I think you can just go, I think it's on Amazon. You can go to Path to Zero.
Okay.
Yeah, and we're on there, and what a delight. I mean, it was wonderful.
Well, let's hear a little bit of it right now.
There's a belief by the children of man which states all will be well. Search on, man.
Beautiful, beautiful. So, Joanne, you've been out there singing in the Vatican, singing in Palestine, working with Jim Morrison. Is there, what else have you been doing?
Well, another thing that I'm working on is a national campaign to bring awareness about what's going on in Indian country for our children, for our youth. We have a lot of suicide. We have a lot of problems, and something I've been working on intently. And I'll have some more news for you on that soon. That'll be the next interview.
Okay. You know, we really look forward to it. And it was so great talking with you again, Joanne. And you're doing so many beautiful things. And it's always exciting to hear where you've been and what you've done. And we thank you so much for coming on.
All right, Ed. We'll talk to you soon, hopefully.
To learn more about Joanne Shenandoah, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
Winter of the World, a New York Times bestseller. Ken Follett follows up his number one New York Times bestseller, Fall of Giants, with a brilliant, page-turning epic about the heroism and honor of World War II and the dawn of the atomic age. Winter of the World picks up right where Fall of the Giants left off, at its five interrelated families: American, German, Russian, English, Welsh. Enter a time of enormous social, political, and economic turmoil, beginning with the rise of the Third Reich, through the Spanish Civil War, and the great dramas of World War II, up to the explosions of the American and Soviet atomic bombs.
After a 10-minute walk, they arrived at a grand villa in a big garden. The Franks were rich. Frieda's father, Ludwig, owned a factory making radio sets. Two cars stood in the driveway. The large, shiny black one belonged to Herr Frank. The engine rumbled, and a cloud of blue vapor rose from the tailpipe. The chauffeur, Ritter, with uniform trousers tucked into high boots, stood cap in hand ready to open the door. He bowed and said, "Good morning, Frau von Ulrich." The second car was a little green two-seater. A short man with a gray beard came out of the house carrying a leather case, and touched his hat to Mother as he got into the small car. "I wonder what Dr. Rothman is doing here so early in the morning," Mother said anxiously. They soon found out. Frieda's mother, Monica, came to the door, a tall woman with a mass of red hair. Anxiety showed on her pale face. Instead of welcoming them in, she stood squarely in the doorway as if to bar their entrance. "Frieda has measles," she said. "I'm so sorry," said Mother. "How is she?" "Miserable. She has a fever and a cough, but Rothman says she'll be all right. However, she's quarantined." "Of course. Have you had it?" "Yes, when I was a girl." "And Werner has too. I remember he had a terrible rash all over. But what about your husband?" Mother asked. "Ludi had it as a boy." Both women looked at Carla. She had never had measles. She realized this meant she could not spend the day with Frieda. Carla was disappointed, But Mother was quite shaken. This week's magazine is our election issue. I can't be absent. She looked distraught. All the grown-ups were apprehensive about the general election to be held next Sunday. Mother and Father both feared the Nazis might do well enough to take full control of the government. Plus, my oldest friend is visiting from London. I wonder whether Walter could be persuaded to take a day off to look after Carla. Monica said, "Why don't you telephone him?" Not many people had phones in their homes, but the Franks did, and Carla and her mother stepped into the hall. The instrument stood on a spindly-legged table near the door. Mother picked it up and gave the number of Father's office at the Reichstag, the Parliament building.
John Lee's narration enhances the complex plot with an impressive assortment of European accents. This grandly scaled epic is enriched by a superb narration, says Audiophile magazine. Ken Follett burst into the book world with Eye of the Needle, an award-winning thriller and international bestseller. After several more successful thrillers, he surprised everyone with The Pillars of the Earth and its long-awaited sequel, World Without End, a national and international bestseller. Follett's magnificent historical epic, The Century Trilogy, opened with the best-selling Fall of Giants. He lives in England with his wife, Barbara. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com. Baby Love Shack. Love Shack. Oh, baby Love Shack. That's where it's at. Signs say, stay away, fools. The club rules at the Love Shack. We're set way back in the middle of a deal. Just a funky old shack. And I gotta get back. Glitter on the mattress. Glitter on the highway. Glitter on the floodlights. Glitter on the highway. The Love Shack is a little old place where we can get together.
Get Behind Me Now, Stay There is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Chrissy McIntyre.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Maya Seligman.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook, and remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.